An interview with Professor Slobodkin on November 17, 1788.
Put it right like that so I can look at it.
Okay. Now, you want to proceed by asking, or I'll answer?
I will ask the questions to begin with, yes. So then after this, you can free.
Okay.
Name, department, rank.
Okay, Leonard Slobodkin, professor of biology, ecology and evolution department.
Right.
And
what year did you come to Stony Brook?
Goodness, this is my 20th year, so it must have been the fall of 68 or 67, I frankly don't remember.
I see, okay. Now how old were you at the time?
Oh, well, that's the way of figuring it out. I was 39 the June before I came.
I see. And from what institution and position did you come?
I was professor of zoology at the University of Michigan.
In Ann Arbor?
In Ann Arbor.
Right. Who was primarily responsible for your coming to Stony Brook?
Well, the three people, Ray Jones and George Williams, came out to Ann Arbor to interview me, to talk me into this thing. Mm-hmm. But I knew of Bentley Glass, and the fact that he was here made it a more likely thing that I would come.
Right. And who interviewed you here for the position?
Well, it was Jones and Williams, and then when I arrived, I met a dean named Ross, who I never, ever saw again.
Yes, Stan Ross.
And I can't recall beyond that.
Beyond that, all right. Why did you come? What factors were
motivated? Okay, several things. First, I'm a New Yorker. I was raised in the city. I left for school when I was 15 and have been back for 1 year when I worked in the hospital there.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Bethany College in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, always a surprise. And then I got my PhD at Yale. So I was a New Yorker, and this is a congenial cultural milieu. Second, the Big Ten schools at that time were putting in restrictions on New York students in the name of what they called geographic diversity. This was to keep out Jews and Italians. I mean, this was their thinking. And they were saying that until New York builds a state university of its own, there's no reason for the citizens of, say, Michigan to pay for the education of New York students, which seemed reasonable to me. Third, I had been approached by the Ford Foundation to develop a program in ecology, and it seemed that Long Island was an excellent place to do it, because all the problems of the world are here, and the only resource is a certain amount of intelligence and a little money. But the things that can't be solved with intelligence and money can't be solved, so it seemed worth trying it here. Fourth, if I'm counting right, Gardner, the curious, who was referred to by Ellen Ripley, the then Secretary of the Smithsonian, as a poseur, voyeur, and a bit of a maquereau. That can go on the table, it's important to get that down before Dylan dies, was Will Rattling at the time. And had promised, he was promising Gardner's Island to 17 different people.
Oh, I see. Yes.
And there was a real prospect of getting Gardner's Island here. As it turns out, nothing happened for a variety of reasons. The university didn't respond properly, and Gardner himself was offering to 7 other places.
They went blind.
And also, it turned out he didn't own it. He had no right to give it to anyone. But this was appealing to me and was one of the attractions, one of the reasons I came. And this ghost stayed alive during my first several years here until it finally vanished. Okay.
Who has Gardner's Island now?
Yale.
Yale?
Yale. It went through Gardner's niece, who attended the forestry school at Yale. Mm-hmm. And to the degree that anyone has it, it's Yale. Mm-hmm. They're not doing much because they don't do much. But I did come with money from the Ford Foundation, sufficient to support some 5 or 6 students, mm-hmm. who I supported for several years. on a John Gagnon was with me in this. I mean, the approach was to me in Michigan, but then I brought it here. And we set up game simulations of environmental decisions on Long Island. It was very good, except that the pressures, well, it didn't come out too well, because my children didn't respond particularly well to coming to the island. There were domestic problems. And I never got any publication out of it at all. But I did. Gagnon did. Gagnon became an expert in game simulation around the world, but I've never let in on that. And Club of Rome and so forth. But it did feed graduate students the first couple of years, which was critical.
What was your understanding of the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook?
Fairly obvious. I mean, the purpose was to build a state university system analogous to the other state university systems, the Big Ten, California, and so on.
Well, Stony Brook itself, did you have any indications that it would be different from Albany and Buffalo?
I had been approached by Albany to take charge of their ecology program a couple of years before I came here. And I did not do it because, they were rather upset actually, because the snow, the location of Albany itself, the isolation, and the fact that they have this single gigantic architectural plan. And that struck me as a very strange way to do a university. Stony Brook I thought of as having access to New York and being in that sense more interesting and better climate.
What about access to the ocean and the sound?
Okay, I at the time owned a sailboat jointly with the chairman of Albany, by the way, in Woods Hole. And it did occur to me that it would be nice to be able to sail from here. And in fact, I still have a boat which I now share with Harvey Lyman. And sail not as much as I'd like, but I do sail. Oh, and also for research purposes. Because initially, there was talk of combining ecology and evolution and the marine sciences program. This fell apart when Don Squires became director of marine sciences. Because what he really does is make things fall apart.
Thus far, I haven't interviewed him, and I haven't interviewed Jerry yet. So I know very little, virtually nothing, about marine sciences.
I had done research in oceanographic work. My own research scatters in many directions. So I've just finished the paper on red tide and brown tide.
Oh, really?
Where I was asked to speak at their conference. But I'd also done work on coral reefs and had been in charge of a marine ecology course at Woods Hole for several years.
I see.
So I had visions of continuing that, which never worked out. Mm-hmm.
Does your work in any way touch the interests of Monica Riley?
In the sense that she's working on evolution, but hers is very much a molecular-based kind of effort.
I see. What were your impressions of Stony Brook when you first came? The campus, the people, the leadership?
Well, the campus was fairly terrible, as you know, it was mud. And the Georgian buildings, which my wife refers to as Georgian penal architecture, the center of the campus.
They've had various names.
But that's fairly appropriate. And so that wasn't much. The area was curious. We bought a house in Oldfield, and we may have been the second Jewish family to move into Oldfield. There was no real sense of a warm welcome there.
It's pretty...
Now it's changed.
Yes.
Now it's changed. Let one of those people in, the whole neighborhood goes to hell. And we did our best to encourage that. Now, so that...
David Fox was out there, wasn't he?
No, he was in Stony Brook, opposite the Mudd School.
Uh-huh.
Bob Smoker was there.
Yes.
But the smokers, the bar smokers, were to wipe them off. And, I think we built the first sukkah ritual tabernacle booth in Oldfield.
How do you spell that now? Sukkah?
Sukkah. S-U-C-C-A-H, I guess.
That's okay.
But it's sort of a thing Orthodox people do at a certain season of the year.
You're Orthodox?
Not really, but close enough.
Close enough. Close
enough. Not stiff Orthodox, no. But any case, so then that, the neighborhood was beautiful, but the neighbors were a little bit...
I think we were the first outside of Bob Smoker. I think we were the first university family.
Yeah,
to move
there was that element also. The schools turned out to be a major disaster because of the prevalence of drugs in schools. And my son's...
Elementary or high school?
Junior high school.
Junior high school.
Yeah. It was very bad for my sons.
This was 68,
69, and there. And it set up a series of very severe personal problems that we all lived with for the next 18 years. As it turns out, all is well. But this was an amazing amount of pain and problem. Now, it is possible that the same thing would have happened in Ann Arbor, but it didn't happen.
Well, when I was in charge of Stony Brook, we had one incident, and a member of the grounds crew, and at the court, I was standing around with some of the county police. And talking, and one chap from the narcotics squad said, "Do you have any drugs at the university?" And I said, "Not to my knowledge." This was 63 or 4. He said, "Well, you'll get it soon. It's coming out from the city."
Well, I don't know where it came from, but in any case, it almost completely crippled me and my family for many years. And the whole behavior that went with it. Now we have the two boys are a violin maker and a physician, and I can't put to ask for better people, but they had a very hard adolescence.
Well, your wife is a very important cog in the musical life of the
she
community.
Wanted connection, more connection with the university, and she became a residence hall advisor.
Residence hall, I said.
When we first arrived, and that entire program was cut out, and the residence hall advisors, which included my wife, Mrs. Levine, Mrs. Wild, a series of faculty wives, who really wanted to work at this, but the entire program was pretty well wiped out. And they were replaced by undergraduates, which was too bad. I mean, there was the hope of a more integrated student life system, which vanished and never returned. It simply never returned. At Michigan, I had been chairman of the committee to set up the Honors College.
Oh, good for you.
And the Honors College of Michigan was set up and it worked very well, but no one here has ever asked me about that. Right up there. And their problem.
Has there ever been any interest in the Honors College here?
The interest in the Honors College here still exists, but it doesn't come through me. It comes through various functionaries. But it has the real problem that it's never been done here at any scale that might work. And it's taken as a way of getting good teachers and good classes for better students on the assumption that we'll have bad teachers and bad classes for worse students. Which strikes me as a very peculiar attitude, and I haven't really been too fond of it.
Okay. What expectations did you have when you came, and have these been, how have they worked out for you personally?
Well, my expectations were to build a school that was primarily sensitive to the students and the graduate students, and at the same time was a research institution. Now, we're not a bad research institution, but we're utterly insensitive to undergraduate student needs, and we still are talking garbage in this area. And I've been beating drums over the years, for example, to require a faculty signature for a student to register, which seems so utterly elementary, to make sure that students don't shoot themselves in the foot every time they register. And it's been now, I've been here 20 years, I've been talking about that for at least 15, and it still doesn't matter. Every 2 years, a new guidance program is set up, most recently by my good friend Aldona, with pictures and, you know, these are the counselors and so on. That doesn't matter, Brother Raw. It really doesn't matter. So our students still are wonderfully ignorant about what they're supposed to do. They're free to do it all by themselves and to destroy themselves, which they do. There's no reason why for this, simply inertia. The inertia is enormous. So at the undergraduate level, I am disappointed. I enjoy my own teaching, but I'm disappointed with what the university tries to do. And curricular reform is not an answer. And
where do you think the answers lie?
I think they lie in, first, a proper counseling system. Not done by professional counselors, but done by faculty.
Right.
Second, an undergraduate teaching requirement for all faculty, whoever the hell they are. Yang doesn't object to this. It's the little pipsqueaks that object to it.
Yeah.
That would go a long way. The idea of recognition, I think, is overrated. I mean, it's as if one has to pay a second salary to get anybody to do anything once you've established their salary. It strikes me as a little bit silly. But if everyone had to be involved in the undergraduate teaching program, it would be a lot better, I think. I mean, these are starters. Coordination of grading systems. One of my complaints, for example, one that I've raised repeatedly and keeps falling apart again. When I was president of the Senate, I brought it up. We had A, B, C, D grades. And then we decided to make plus and minus grades in addition. The nursing school had a requirement for C grades for admission. When the minus grades came in, which had been a part of the C grade, a C minus was not eligible for nursing school, although it would have been if the plus and minuses hadn't been added. And no one's been ever able to get that straight. So a C minus grade, which was not originally intended as a penalty grade, has become a severe penalty grade. And the people most susceptible to it, most damaged by it, are the somewhat poorer students who have the dedication to become nurses or social workers or what have you. They're mainly black, they're mainly poor, and they're serious good kids who just ain't that great academically. But they managed. And if we hadn't, with a stroke of a pen, put in plus and minus grades, they would continue to manage. Now that strikes me as an abomination which could have been solved at any point by any kind of activity from anyone in authority and never was.
It still holds.
It still holds. I've given up.
Well, now, who has the authority to make the change?
The registrar's office can what I wanted was the registrar's office to eliminate the C-minus grade. They say, well, that's not symmetrical. Well, symmetry isn't my boss.
No.
Right. I don't give a damn about symmetry. Well, you can't do that. Why not? Well, you can't. And that's where it is. So, Marburger, any secretary in Marburger's office, the registrar, Preston, anyone could say, okay, fellas, we're redoing the grade form, so there's no space on the IBM form for a C-minus grade. That could be done. You could, but goodness, that would mean throwing away all the forms. Well, fuck the forms.
Yeah.
So we do things like that.
Yeah.
That's an example. And we pay for it. I mean, the quality of our students has come down. It is known in the state university system that we're not the elite school for undergraduates that we were 20 years ago or 15 years ago. We're the school for the dropouts. And that's known through the state. And that's what we do. And it's largely a matter of, well, there's a, I don't really know, but I have a suspicion of a kind of civil service mentality trying to run an educational institution.
That's not only here, but it's pretty much all over the state.
Somehow Bingham and Albany haven't had that much of a problem. Because somewhere the leadership has said, cut it out. Get on with business.
Mm-hmm.
And we've never been able to do that. We've never been able to do that. Since you asked.
Well,
this probably, you know, this is going to go in the files and no one's going to give a damn yet. But at least in principle, I said.
Yeah, well, this is not a, this is not a program to whitewash the institution in any sense.
I do believe this is focal. We have a peculiar educational role. Gelber once stated it very nicely. He said, at its best, Stony Brook is City College in the 30s run by two Princeton men.
Say it again?
It's City College in the 30s run by two Princeton men when we're at our very best. What does he mean? It means that, in fact, most of our undergraduate students are either the first or second generation of college-educated people. Essentially, all of our undergraduate students have at least one foreign grandparent. We should be the access to American professional class for these people, to American civilization for these people. Not television civilization, but the highest of American civilization, which is what City College was instead. I don't think we are. I don't think we are cognizant of it. Marburger, I've been told, actually said, well, you know, what can college do against these home backgrounds? Well, screw that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's bad news. And we're paying for it. I am now old enough, I'm 60. It won't die with me. During my time, I'll be fine. But it's not getting better.
We have a lot of unfinished business from the home. And we're not capable, we're not at least recognizing the fact, and we're not figuring out how to handle it successfully.
That's it. Because I remember college, I don't know about you, but my father's an artist, but I was raised in the Bronx. And the sense was that the school was an opening to the whole big world, just tremendous. You suddenly find you're really reading Plato. My God, I'm reading Plato. I'm reading Darwin. I'm reading all these great things. What a wonderful world it is. And I don't feel it now, kids. I try it in my classes. I get some of it. And they, you know, you really have been doing that. You really have to think. Well, go ahead to think. I want to be an optometrist. But you hit them often enough, they get the idea. And once they get the idea, it's great. The lights turn on. I mean, it's amazing to watch their faces when you do that. Wonderful. But I can't, because of the structure of the university, it is inappropriate for me to excessively stress my own undergraduate role, because it would be professional suicide with my colleagues. To teach undergraduates means that you're an idiot and a sucker. And this isn't far off.
It doesn't mean that at Harvard.
No, it doesn't.
No.
And it isn't far off, because anyone who we have our so-called great teachers. Some of them are good. But there are others who really are idiots and suckers. Mm-hmm. And this sets the tone. This is what we've got. And it requires what? It requires courageous leadership, leadership we have. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is no one ever asked it. Any of us.
Yeah. Well, I went to Western.
Mm-hmm. Connecticut Western.
Connecticut Western.
Yeah.
And it was a good school with excellent teachers. And I was interested in teaching after my graduate work, which was at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And I sympathize with faculty who take their teaching seriously. I saw enough of Harvard College, know enough about Harvard and its the loyalty of its undergraduates, people who graduated from the college itself, and the devotion of the administration to Harvard College, which is
That's
really
right.
the core.
And
of the
Columbia College,
yeah.
and Yale College, and the Michigan undergraduates
right.
are all the same.
Yeah.
Now, Illinois is different. They don't really give a damn too much about the undergraduates. Wisconsin, I think, has the same problem. But Berkeley certainly thinks they care about their undergraduates by not having many of them. There's another important point. When I came here, Rockefeller was governor, and he was a rich man building a university. He thought like a rich man.
Mm-hmm.
And knew what a university was.
Yes, he was by a bit of capital.
It must be admitted, as a dyslexic, and presumably he only paid moderate amounts for his ghostwriters, that's an accomplishment. But our present governor graduated from St. John's, and really thinks St. John's is a university. There's a big difference.
Yes.
Right. I mean, it isn't even Jesuit, for goodness sake, it's Dominican.
It's what?
St. John's is Dominican. It's yes. not Jesuit. Same lovable fellows who brought us the Inquisition. These are elements. That I didn't we're getting away from.
Yes, and Kerry also
yeah.
was pretty total.
In fact, though.
Were your activities confined to the Stony Brook campus, or did you have relations outside, either with the central office or with the discipline?
No, my relations with the discipline are central. The central office I had nothing to do with. But while during my years here, I've been visiting professor in Puerto Rico, in Italy, in Israel, primarily those. And the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, the Woods Hole Marine Biological Laboratory. And I co-authored material with people from all of these places, in Italy, in Milan, at Ferrara, at Pavia, in Israel, in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv, in Beersheba. I've been president of the American Society of Naturalists, which is the oldest natural history at Ecology Society in America, so has Sokol for that matter, and president of the General Systems Research Society.
Speak
and
up
so
a little louder.
Oh.
I'm not quite sure whether that's getting...
Okay. No, but I've been president of several national societies. I was editor of the American Naturalist, but I stopped because of the problems with my sons. But I'm on the editorial board now of Evolutionary Ecology, the Indian Journal of Genetics, a couple of others, I forget what.
Mm-hmm.
So that I've had a lot of activity in my field associated with research. Now, more because of my age and how long I've been doing this, I've reached what they refer to as one's anecdotage. So I find myself giving a lot of plenary session addresses and things of that sort. This does take time. And write papers, wrote a lot of papers, and now I've got a book contract with Harvard that I have to work on, and so forth. So there's been a lot of activity, which is not Stony Brook activity.
Yeah.
Here, I was president of the Senate, as you know, and was senator for years, and won a lot of committees, and I'm not on any now, which is very nice.
Yes.
I think I've sort of been hiding.
What about, you've mentioned the quality of students and the decline in the quality.
Undergraduates.
Undergraduates.
Yeah.
The graduate students still holding up?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I'm sometimes surprised at their lack of general vocabulary.
Yeah.
But their scientific knowledge is very good.
I'm afraid that's a national defect at the present time.
Now, it should be pointed out that the Ecology Evolution Department was what I founded here.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first ecology and evolutionary department in the world.
Is that right?
Well, no one had thought of putting that together. I set it up for a specific reason, namely that in biology departments around the country and around the world, that maintained their unity as departments. The biochemists and molecular geneticists were being called on to evaluate the work of ecologists. And it's really quite impossible. I mean, how do they tell whether a man hunting frogs is doing science or not? At the same time, I don't know half the words they're using. I don't want to have to judge them. So we split. But we became a model. And now there are some, at least 15 or 20 departments with this, almost the same name or the same name around the country.
Evolution and ecology.
Evolution and ecology. Or ecology and evolution, I think. But you find evolution and ecology, population, biology, and evolution. I mean, names like that.
Yeah.
All around the country. But we were the first.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a choice. I could either be a program in the biology department or set up my own department. I was brought here to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to deal with that. And I chose to set up my own department, and it's become a model,
good,
nationally and internationally.
Well, that would be something you should be proud of.
It's a good department, and not always a peaceful department, but a good department.
Okay. What about faculty life, the relations of faculty to each other? And is this a community of scholars?
Within this department, to a large degree, yes. Now, it hasn't always been that way. That is, I was chairman for a while, I stopped it, I went on sabbatical, and then another chairman came in. And he was more of an authoritarian figure.
Yes, right. I just want to check this thing. Still going, and we've got a lot of tape.
Yes. He was more of an authoritarian figure, and there were certain internal pressures. And I noticed during that interval, which is the beginning of my second decade here, that the conversation in the hall was more about academic backbiting,
yes,
than about science. So I sort of engineered a revolution to give us a new chairman, not me, but another chairman. And I became chairman briefly again to get it back, to sort of calm everything down and get back to thinking. As of the moment, I think the graduate students and faculty feel good about the department, feel bad about the university. But I think this is almost typical in the better departments of Stony Brook. That is, the English department, the physics department, certain parts of history, and so forth and so forth, all feel, yes, we're great scholars, but the administration is lousy.
What can be done about it? If you were president, what would you do?
I'd shoot myself first. Then! No. I'm not sure. I haven't thought of that. But it has to be taken as a serious job. And the seriousness I miss. I get the sense, I've said this to the president, I've said it to Schubel, that what we're best at is announcing new initiatives and new programs. And we get the engine all gussied up, and we get the whistle blowing, and we get the flags waving, and we stand at the station, and we say, huzzah, huzzah, and then it goes anywhere. And this is true over and over again. And at this point, no one gives a damn about new initiatives. So new initiatives is not it. Making the old initiatives work is a very good idea.
I've always thought that the secret is really in the kind as well as the quality of the individuals that you bring on the faculty.
Absolutely. Now, there's no secret. I mean, it's, you know, you can make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, but it's very hard.
Yeah.
Very, very hard.
You've got to bring in a certain kind of individual who carries his specialty within a broad frame of reference and who is able to deal easily with other people, isn't afraid of other
people.
This
is getting harder and harder. And it's not just us. And this is not our fault. But in the more technically advanced hard sciences, which we are not, by the way, the soft,
yes.
If they want to do that, if they want to do that kind of science, they become very strange people. My son is studying surgery at the moment, and he's pretty well decided that surgeons are crazy. And maybe he doesn't want to study that. It's the same thing. I mean, we focus on a technical excellence becomes so high, there's not room for much else.
Do you know Andy Jackson in the physics department?
No, I don't. I'm bad on names.
Well, he's a co-professor in Jerry Brown's group. You and he would have a lot in common. Great deal in common. It's along the same lines that you do.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Princeton PhD undergraduate, but he likes his teaching, believes in it, but he's also a scholar.
Yeah, but you asked a community of scholars. Interesting
yes.
Things, we don't have a campus town. And
campus town?
A town.
Yeah.
So that various people have various other activities which bring them into contact with a subset of faculty. Apart from the university, but not the kind of pervasive communion that you'll find in other places, as say in Ann Arbor when I was there. So that there are a lot of faculty who belong to choral societies or music groups or churches or synagogues.
Yeah.
And this is really a place where these are the places where you meet people from other disciplines. Because your kids share a junior high school, or because you both play the violin or something.
Yeah. Well, there's no faculty club.
Well, there's a group.
There's an effort.
Again, we're standing at the station when the bells are clanging.
Yeah.
For many years, there are a group of chemists, mathematicians, and me that tend to have lunch in the student cafeteria. And the union. Filthy, grungy, not too jestable, but good company. And
with the end of the bridge? Or
No, downstairs.
Downstairs.
Cheap, quick lunch.
I see.
And within the last 3 months, that has pretty well been destroyed, although it's been going on for around a decade, by the management saying, we can't use the ballroom, you have to all squeeze into one room, and there isn't room for people there. And these things happen and no one notices. But it's a dispersion of something that was very good. I mean, isn't the question of they made a bad decision yesterday? The bad decisions continue. And are by and large small decisions that no one notices. The student study halls at night sort of manage that way. Things of that. And I get the feeling, I really do get the feeling that a large share of the administration is simply shell-shocked that they came, that specifically Marburger came with very high aspirations and very good intentions, and is now a very, very tired man. I can't blame him. I wouldn't want his job. But somehow one has to break through that exhaustion. Not on the level of fronting for the university, but on the level of little like details, like the ballroom is closed at lunch. And interdisciplinary communication of faculty involving four departments is gone. Interesting. That happens in the last 2-3 months.
I wonder how many people know this. You know it, because you're affected.
Yeah, no one.
I see.
I mean, this is what we mean by lack of sensitivity.
Yes. Okay. You've covered this to a certain extent. What do you feel you had accomplished at Stony Brook by the time that you came? I have 71 here. These are the early years, supposedly, but let's advance it.
What do you mean?
In terms of
I'm not sure what you're asking.
It's 14. You have really answered that question, I think.
By 1971, we had a actual department, the first department of its kind. We had a research reputation that wasn't bad. Mm-hmm. We were, I think, in the field among the top half dozen departments. And certainly the top department that had no proper field facilities. A department like this, I was at Duke University giving a lecture last week. They had 10,000 acres of forest they worked with. And Michigan had something similar.
Michigan State has 18,000.
Yeah, it's absolutely gigantic. We have none. Until this semester we've had none. And nevertheless, we're doing ecology and evolution. So for a department in that strait, we're probably the best around.
I tried hard to get the central office to understand that it would have to acquire a lot more land than Ward Melville had originally given.
Yeah.
And I was able to get them to acquire 150 acres across the road, Nichols mm-hmm. Road. Thanks really to a suggestion from Bayless Winters, Ward Melville's chief factotum, and also to get the land where the south parking lot is. But Herb Gordon, who was at the time in charge of land acquisition for the university system as a whole,
couldn't see it.
Told me that he had proposed these things, and the board of trustees kept saying to him, "We're not in the land acquisition business." They were just not looking.
Well, we have no tradition of university management in this state.
That's right.
There's another aspect to it. The so-called privates, struck me as an obscene way of describing it, but we were built as the pauper's university. Think of it.
Yes.
That is, we could at no point put a proper portico on a building. We could not have a good-looking lobby because it would anger the privates. It's very interesting because the private university has a kind of class to it. We deliberately had to avoid that kind of class because we were sneaking ourselves into existence around a legislation, around a board of trustees who had been educated at Columbia, Rochester, Syracuse, and so forth. And paupers universities don't need land.
Well, we were able to get about 1,100.
We managed, kind of, but that's always been a shadow of Stony. The idea that we are, in fact, the cheapest university around, which we are, I mean, typically the state university system is, it does not mean that it's either inferior or that our students should get an inferior deal. you train students because the state needs students, if you want to think of it that way.
Also, because
if you choose the students you train on the dual grounds that they are wealthy and educable, you must get a lower quality than if you choose them strictly on the grounds that they're educable. It's the distinction between Harvard and Yale. Lux et Veritas. And a second qualification, the quality has to go down. And Yale's never been able to keep up with Harvard.
Not sure that I understand what you're saying.
Saying this, that, consider medical schools. My son went to the University of Tel Aviv Medical School, where money was not an issue, because he was living in Israel all these years. But in our medical schools, the current tuition rates are of the order of $25,000 a year. It costs the parents to send the child to medical school. How many smart people do you know? Question one. How many smart people do you know whose parents can afford $25,000 a year? The second category is much smaller than the first one. Therefore, if I confine my choices to people who have both $25,000 a year and minimal intelligence, I'm going to get pretty well minimal intelligence. If I'm not restricted by the financial qualification, I can get much better people. And this is why you should take vitamins and try to stay healthy. Because what comes out of the medical school are prosperous idiots. And my son with his $400 a year medical school, which is what it was, comes here for residency and is in the 98th and 99th percentile of every generalized test he ever takes.